When we think about Jesus and his suffering at the end of his life, oftentimes I believe the attention is focused on the cross. We, in this class, do not want to take any attention or any focus off that, but there is another aspect of what Jesus went through, and that would be the irregular proceedings that he had with the trials. And that's something that's almost never talked about. Occasionally someone might say a little something about it, but there's a lot there. Maybe this isn't discussed too much because you have very few attorneys who are Christians. There have been some who have tried to write books on this, maybe some articles on it. You see that at various times in some publications and so forth. But there's actually a lot here. There are a couple of ways to do it. There is what I think of as a biblical way. We can go into the scriptures and show from the Bible what Jesus experienced, and that's the focus of this class. It would also be possible to go into some of the first century Jewish literature and look at what the Jews had as far as laws and try to make some comparisons between what we have in the Bible, what the laws said, and point out the distinctions. That's not the focus of this class, but that is something that could be done. You'll notice that we have 32 points on the paper. All the references are here. I think that our timing is going to be about right for the class, so hopefully that turns out to be correct. And under points 1 and 2, you have a couple of introductory thoughts. When we think about history, whether that's recent history or in the distant past, you do have a lot of situations where justice has been miscarried. You've had innocent people imprisoned, innocent people punished, sometimes innocent people killed, and vice versa. Sometimes you have the guilty who are freed and so forth. So when we think about Jesus, there was a great miscarriage of justice. In his case, that fulfilled God's plan, but crooked judges, crooked courts have existed for a long time. If you go back in the Old Testament and you start looking through the Old Testament prophets, you begin to find that that was a big, big complaint that some of the prophets had. The courts, the systems that they had in place for judicial matters, oftentimes it was unjust. All right, when we start to look at the irregularities, the things that were illegal regarding Jesus' trials, it really is astounding. I'm not sure I have covered everything that you can find about that, but I hope I'm in at least the higher 90% range as far as all the things that we can find that are related primarily in the New Testament that go to it. Let's begin with Luke chapter 22, verses 3 through 6. This would seem to me to be a good beginning point. And we'll just take these one by one. We'll try to move through them a little more slowly than we normally do so we can sort of let this sink in. Luke 22, starting with verse 3 and going down through verse 6. Who wants to be here? Steve, you have your hand up first, I think, so I'll take you.
Then Satan entered Judas, surnamed Iscariot, who was numbered among the 12. So he went his way and conferred with the chief priests and captains how he might betray him to them. And they were glad and agreed to give him money.
What happens today when you have a legal system and there's a case which involves some kind of bribery or some kind of payoff? People feel like it's on the up and up? No. Sometimes that happens. If the whole case isn't thrown out, at least that aspect of it might be dismissed, or they will say, we need something in place of that. We just can't accept that. But you start off with a really bad sense. You have Judas. He's working with the officials who are going to be involved with Jesus' trials, and there is this under-the-table dealing. And it's very messy from the beginning. But that's just the start. If this is all that had been done, okay, really bad, not legal, not right, but we might say that things worse could have happened, but didn't, but that's certainly not where it stops. Now, in our next reference, we're going to leave the life of Christ for a little bit and head over and look at Acts 9. We could also look at Acts 22, verse 12, but we'll just look at Acts chapter 9, verses 1 and 2. Today, if you're going to be arrested by the police, and this isn't a situation where you're out doing something, you're perhaps in your own home, the police are not looking at you, it's not like they have seen you out in the road and you were speeding or something, they're going to arrest you. What's the procedure? What has to go before they come knocking on the door or breaking down your door? All right, there has to be some kind of legal paperwork. There may be a search warrant. If it's not a search warrant, what else might they have? They might have a warrant for your arrest. They've gone to a judge and said, we need a search warrant or we have cause to arrest this person. And the judge says, okay, you can have a warrant. That's how the Jews operated. We know that, again, because of Acts 26, but also this passage earlier in the book, Acts 9, 1 and 2. Who's there and wants to read that? All right, Gary, we'll start with you.
And Saul, yet breathing out threatenings and slaughter against the disciples of the Lord, went unto the high priest and desired of him letters to Damascus to the synagogues, that if he found any of this way, whether they were men or women, he might bring them bound unto Jerusalem.
Okay, we're probably familiar with what happened there. Similar information in Acts 26, but I'm not sure that we've often connected that to the trials of Jesus. That's what should have been done. They should have gotten that legal authority, that legal paperwork. But these fellows, they're worked up into a frenzy. They've reached the point where Jesus in their minds needs to die, and that was not done. So you can start putting the pieces together. Luke chapter 22, there was the bribery, there was the payoff. They don't do things according to the standard that they had, the legal standard. I would also argue that that was consistent with the biblical standard. And then, as Jesus, even before he gets to the mob, he has an understanding of who is going to come against him. Now today, if you were to think about being arrested, you would say, well, who's going to come get me? The police, the authorities, law enforcement. Notice how Jesus describes the people who came to get him. He's very specific about this. It's in Matthew chapter 26, verse 45. Who wants to be a helper for that, Carol? Matthew 26, 45. Let's figure out what the key word is. Sinners. There it is. Now, we covered that a few weeks back, but now look at it from a different perspective tonight. Jesus said, I'm going to be betrayed into whose hands? Into the hands of sinners. Does that sound like people who are law-abiding or not? They don't sound too law-abiding. And what do we find? Don mentioned earlier in John chapter 18 where we've been. Remember that mob that comes out? We talked about the fact that the word that's used could describe 600 men. Now, that doesn't mean that 600 people actually came out. But there was this very great multitude that was surely in the hundreds of people. And that's what you have. This is, they call it mob justice, which is sort of a misnomer, but that's really what you have. Anything that went out or ask up until this point? Okay, let's take a look at our next reference. Luke chapter 22, verse 52 is next. All right, Maxine, we'll take your hand and help. Okay, who's there? Not the Romans, but we have the chief priests along with the elders. Guess who was going to be involved in prosecuting Jesus? These guys. Now, how would you feel if you have been arrested and the arresting officer or the arresting officers are going to be the same people or is the same person that's going to be your judge? Have a warm and fuzzy feeling about a fair trial? I wouldn't. I mean, they're binding you, they're treating like you're a criminal, and you're thinking, I've already been judged, and I've already been condemned, and, sentence, we don't even need to get back and go through the proceedings and so forth, because really the matter has already been decided. How important is impartiality when it comes to our judicial system, or should be in any system? All right. And, you know, if the judge is not impartial, then you really can't often get what?
Justice.
Fair. Anybody ever been to the Supreme Court in Washington? Oh, come on. The class this size, nobody's ever been there? I've been told, I've not seen it, we could probably find it on Google Images, but I've been told that there is an image there, I'm not sure if it's over both eyes, but there is a stone carving of somebody, and there's a blindfold over at least one eye, maybe both eyes. I have no reason to disbelieve that. But if that's right, what's the powerful message? If you come here to the Supreme Court of the land, what's going to be true? We're going to be, or at least we should be, impartial. You're going to get a fair hearing. We're not going to be predisposed to this view or that view or this person or that person. If you're rich, if you're poor, if you are from this background or that background, it does not matter. But Jesus was denied that as he goes through his process. Anything you want to add or ask? Okay, let's see what we've got with point 8. We dealt with point 7. This comes from Matthew 26, verse 34. Who wants to be your helper? All right, Lois?
Jesus said to him, truly I say to you that this very night, before he cock crows, you shall deny me three times.
Okay. What time of day is Jesus taken? He said, at this night. That helps explain what we've seen from John chapter 18. Remember the torches that we talked about? Hundreds of people. You would not need that, obviously, during the daytime. Now, if you're going to arrest somebody, might you arrest them during the day? Sure. Might you arrest them during the night? Yeah, you're probably going to arrest the person whenever you can get them. So the arrest is not really that important. But with Jesus, it was a little distinctive. Remember from last week's class, Jesus said, I sat where? Daily in the temple, and I was teaching you. So if you wanted to come out and grab me, you had all these opportunities. But when did you decide to come out and get me? At night. Now, again, if that had been a detail in and of itself, nothing else had been there, no bribery, none of the information, not such a big deal. But as we started to learn last time, a week ago from John chapter 18, Jesus is arrested at night, and then what immediately happens? He's taken off to the trial. So, deductive reasoning. When were his trials? Nighttime. Now, what would you think about a secret proceeding or several secret proceedings at night? That almost sounds like something from the CIA, doesn't it? They're going to take you off and interrogate you and try you, and it's anything but fair. But that's what happened to the Lord. All right, we had a couple of hands generated. Was Steve, you were first.
Well, if he was doing, a lot of what he was doing was in the daylight and the people were there to see it, but then they snuck it. Pretty much snuck in the way. Not as many people are going to know it.
Yes.
Especially at this time when there's not all the streets are not lit up and everything like they are now. The opposition would be there as great to say, hey, you can't do this. They don't even know what's happening to all these people.
Yeah. That's true.
They whisked them away.
They were afraid of the people. It was,
some of them might have known,
yes,
about, not nearly as many.
Yeah. If you're going to be involved with a miscarriage of justice and you have people that might see that and object to that, you probably want to find a workaround. And that was definitely part of the calculation that as far as taking Jesus. So, good thought there. Carol, did you have a point?
I was just going to say, often when people are doing things that are evil or that they know are wrong, they will sneak around at night and talk about,
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Light on, whatever they're doing.
Yeah. There are some police that like to work at night just because it's a more lively shift between about 12 and 7. I mean, that's where things really start to happen. So when people, we talk about the cover of darkness, for example, and there's a reason that people use that expression, and that's exactly what we have here, plus the point that Steve just made. Anybody else? Okay, let's move down and see what we've got from John chapter 2, verses 15 and 16. And then coupled with that, we're also going to have Mark 11, 15 through 18 read. Now these verses might not be passages that you would immediately connect with what we're talking about, but they do connect, and they do connect very, very well. John 2, 15 and 16. Who wants that one? All right, Betty. And then after that, we'll take a look at Mark chapter 11, verses 15 and 18. Let's take a look at that. That'll be Brian. So let's start with John chapter 2, 15 and 16. Betty, going back to you.
So he made a whip of cords and drove them out of the temple court with the sheep and the oxen. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their table.
All right, now this is somewhat early in Jesus' ministry. So you have a period of about roughly 3 years between John 2 and Mark chapter 11. If you had someone go into the temple and do this, you think you'd still recall it 3 years later?
Yeah.
It's not going to be something that's soon forgotten. It's just one of the things that looms large in the minds of people. So Jesus does that, really shakes things up. Now about 3 years later, not very long before he is involved with the mob and he's being arrested and so forth, he does the same thing again. Mark chapter 11, 15 and 18. Brian?
And they come to Jerusalem, and Jesus went into the temple and began to cast out them that sold and bought in the temple, and overthrew the tables of the money changers and the seats of them that sold doves. And the scribes and chief priests heard it and sought how they might destroy him, for they feared him, because all the people were astonished at his doctrine.
Okay, so some religious officials are upset. Specifically, we learned that in Mark 11, verse 18, and certainly back in John 2, they would not have been too enthused. Now, can you begin to see, or would you like to venture a guess, as to why this becomes significant in relation to Jesus' arrest and trials? Remember, I told you last week, how many aspects of Jesus' trials do we have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6? 6. Okay, and well, Don was holding up three fingers, but he's right. How many were Jewish?
Three.
How many were Roman? Three. All right. When you look at, and Ray closed out the question, the class last week with this question. He asked why both Annas and Caiaphas were referred to as high priest. And the reason for that I gave was sort of like the police commissioner, or it's like an ex-president. You still refer to people by the job that they had. And that title generally was held by people until they died. It was an office that was sort of passed around. It was more of a political thing in the first century. Now, if you had been the high priest, Annas, Caiaphas, just like some politicians today, you think you've probably got some money coming in? Yeah. And where do you think part of those funds might come from? Uh-huh. Because remember one of the shenanigans that the Jews pulled? You've come from 100 miles out of town. You've brought in your animal. And you go there to the temple, and you're ready to make your sacrifice. What do they tell you? Not good enough. You can keep your animal, but if you want to honor God, what do you need to do? You need to buy our animal. And to buy our animal, what do you need? This coinage. You've got this stuff from out of town. Now, we can help you out. We can exchange your money for a small rate, just like they do in banks here and overseas. And after you get the right money, then you can go ahead and get the right animal, and that's going to work out fine. We see that same kind of stuff happening today. And the high priests were associated with that kind of stuff. So if that's where you're getting your money from, and these guys were wealthy, men like Annas and Caiaphas, if that's where you're getting your money from, had there not been the event in Mark chapter 11, do you think you would have remembered back there in John chapter 2 what this guy did to you? Uh-huh. And now, not long prior to this time, he comes and he pokes you in the eye again, goes back and does the same thing. And now you're going to appear before him. What kind of trial do you think you're going to have? It's not going to be a fair one. So, small details, but very, very important. Anything that you want to ask before we skip back to Luke chapter 22 and see what we've got in verse 54? Okay, Luke chapter 22, verse 54. Let's see where Jesus' trial was held. Who wants to? Okay, Gary. Okay, the high priest's house, that would have been the house of Caiaphas. Remember, Caiaphas, high priest, John chapter 2, Mark chapter 11. If you're going to be tried somewhere, where would you expect to be tried? All right, courthouse or some public building. But the judge says, oh, hey, just come over to my house. Let's have the trial here. Seems a little off, doesn't it? You know that something is not right. Either he's going to try to sweep something under the rug and cover something up, or you know that this is a sham and it's not going to go well for you. And, of course, the latter is what we have when it comes to Jesus. So the Lord's trial, point 12, should have been a public event. It should have been held during the day, and that was also consistent with the Jewish laws that they had, the Mishnah and so forth, non-biblical laws. But they violated all those as well. All right, now, point 13. Let's go back to the Old Testament. We'll look at three references here. We'll start with Deuteronomy 19, then take a look at Numbers 35, and then also see Deuteronomy 17, verse 6. Let's begin with Deuteronomy 19, verses 15 through 21. You have here a principle, or a couple of principles, involving Old Testament justice. Deuteronomy 19, 15 to 21. Longer reading, but who wants it? Jeff. Thank you. Several important points there. Number one, God said when it comes to the witnesses, is one enough? No. You need at least two or three. And when he said, if there is a false witness, then bring the matter. Things are not going quite right. Bring the matter before God. Bring the matter before the priests, the judges, and so forth. And that all needs to be sorted out for a decision. And then, if you have a false witness, what's supposed to happen to him? All right, he's going to suffer the punishment that should have been suffered by the other guy. We've not gotten there yet, but were there some false witnesses when it came to the Lord? Yes. So passages like Deuteronomy 19, 15 to 21, completely disregarded. Then we have this, Numbers 35, 30 and Deuteronomy 17, 6. Let's look at both of those. Numbers 35, 30, who wants it? Numbers 35, Brian. And then Deuteronomy 17, 6. Deuteronomy 17, verse 6. All right, Tina. Brian, Numbers 35, 30.
Whoso killeth any person, the murderer shall be put to death by the mouth of witnesses. The one witness shall not testify against any person to cause him to die.
Okay, so you start thinking about the witnesses. It wasn't enough to have one man put Jesus to death by his word. There needed to be multiple witnesses, and by implication, they needed to agree. But that was not done. That was a clear violation of the Old Testament principle you have here. Tina, Deuteronomy 17, 6.
Whoever is enduring death shall be put to death on the testimony of two or three witnesses.
Okay.
He shall not be put to death on the testimony of one witness.
Okay, so when you start looking at this, multiple places in the Old Testament, God said, if you're going to be involved with the death penalty, it's got to be a very, very serious matter. It needs to be dealt with very, very carefully. And that's not what's being done as we start unfolding the facts when it comes to Jesus. Let's take a look at this. This is point 15 from Luke chapter 23, verses 50 and 51. Done?
A man named Joseph, who was a member of the council, a good and righteous man, he had not considered to their plan and action. A man from Arimathea, city of the Jews, who was waiting for the kingdom of God.
Okay. You have all the people, as far as the Sanhedrin, they're condemning the Lord. Joseph of Arimathea was a member of that group, but he didn't consent to the Lord's death. He wasn't there. He was favorably disposed towards the Lord. Now, how would you feel if you are being taken to trial, and you've got false witnesses, all the corruption that we've talked about, all the illegal practices by the judge, and there's at least one solid witness for you? And for whatever reason, maybe he's not told about the proceedings, maybe he's kept from the proceedings, whatever the reason is, and we don't know exactly why Joseph was not there, but that witness is not sought, that witness is not brought, and that witness doesn't testify on your behalf. How would you feel? I think I'd be pretty upset that there was someone that could have spoken on my behalf, someone who was an honorable man, someone who was a respected man, someone who was a member of the court, if you will, and yet he was not allowed to speak on behalf of Jesus. Then point 16, this is more of a deduction. You do have a hint or two at it in John chapter 18, but if you're going to, I saw a few years back a judge charged with a crime. The judge was a member of the church, and it was more of a civil matter than, so crime is probably not the right, wrongdoing, I guess would be a better word. The judge was a member of the church, well known, and he didn't represent himself. He went out and got other legal representation. I know with some work in the local jail, I had a jailer tell me one time, if you go down, and this may not be true of all jails, but I think it's true of many, if you go into the library, oftentimes jails will have a very nice law library. In fact, the law library in a jail might be better than what some attorneys have, at least some young attorneys. But I do remember a jailer telling me one time that out of all the people that he had seen who tried to represent themselves, in every case, they failed. And that can be for a couple of reasons. If you've not been trained as a lawyer, you might not do very well. The old adage is, what is it? You're a fool for a client if you represent yourself. I think that's how it goes or something like that as far as an attorney. But even if you've got the lawyerly knowledge, and there are exceptions, but even if you have that knowledge, you still can be emotionally involved in the case. And it's like a doctor cutting on a family relative. It's better to be emotionally distant from the patient. In this case, it's better to be emotionally distant from the client. But Jesus was not afforded, as far as what we can tell, and we'll see this, as I say, reflected a little more fully a little later here in John chapter 18, verses 19 and 21, no legal representation. And that also was wrong. So here you have a positive witness for him, Joseph of Arimathea. He's not there for whatever reason. Jesus does not receive any legal representation. And then, on top of all those things, let's see what John tells us in chapter 18, verses 19 and 21. Who has it and wants to read? Gary, back to you.
The high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine. Jesus replied, "Why askest thou me? Ask them which heard me, what I have said unto them. Behold, they know what I have said."
Okay, now let's break these two verses down. Let's go back to verse 19. Read it once more, if you would.
The high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine.
Okay. Try to imagine that you're Jesus, you're in a courtroom, the prosecutor slash judge is asking you the questions that you have here. What's being asked by this high priest? What's he trying to get Jesus to do? Self-incrimination. That wasn't legal. You can ask questions, but you can't try to have the guy self-incriminate himself. And that's what he was asking for the Lord to do. So this was also illegal. Now, if the Lord had had a defense attorney, what do you think the attorney would have done?
Objection.
Stop that. We can't have that. That's illegal. But Jesus is on his own. Now, you could say he was the Son of God, and you know that was far better than any attorney. I think that would certainly be true. But still, that doesn't undermine or dismiss the previous point. And then notice how Jesus responds to that. Let's go back, Gary, one more time and take a look at verse 21. Jesus, what? After being asked to incriminate himself, this is his reply, 21.
Why askest thou me? Ask them which heard me, what I have said unto them. Behold, they know what I have said.
Can't you just see Jesus responding to the prosecutor? Why are you trying to get me to incriminate myself? If you have any questions, you're the prosecutor. What's your job? Go and find out the facts. You go and get the facts. Don't ask me to incriminate myself. So this really is stunning, but this is what was done to the Lord. Then if that's not bad enough, you still there, Gary?
Yeah.
All right, so Jesus responds truthfully. He responds forcefully. And this is what happens to him. John 18, verse 22.
And when he had thus spoken, one of the officers which stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, "Answerest thou the high priest so?"
Now imagine that you are being prosecuted for something. You're in the courtroom. You've been asked some questions, asked to incriminate yourself. You don't have a defense lawyer. This guy is going after you. You give an answer, and the bailiff comes over and whacks you across the mouth. You think that would make the news? Not legal in our culture, not legal in this culture as well. And yet that is exactly what happened to Jesus. So it should have been really outrageous. There should have been a great objection to that, but that simply is not what happened. Yeah. I would think it's an instant mistrial, and you're probably going to be able to sue for an untold number of damages. But it's just unbelievable that as you start looking through this sequentially, all the awful things that happened to the Lord and just how illegal the trials were. But as I said, that's something that's hardly ever taught or discussed.
This wasn't the first illegal trial that they had, was it?
We should, at this point, be with the Sanhedrin, Don. So he's already been before Annas and Caiaphas. So he's now into the third aspect of that.
No, but I mean, it was more than they had conducted illegal trials before Jesus.
Okay, remember you've got Annas, Caiaphas, the high priest, then the Sanhedrin, and then we have...
I'm talking before Jesus.
Other people. Well, when you look at how Caiaphas and Annas were as far as high priests, they were not known. And we talked about that a little bit last week. As far as Pilate, he was not a just man. And it was just... We're hearing a lot about political corruption in the United States right now. Whether or not that's true or not, people have always had in many countries difficulties with political corruption, and the Jews had it too. The Romans had it, the Jews had it, and it was a system which caused people to be really upset. So yes, it was a system where, and you know, it goes back. You can go back into the time of Amos and so forth. You have Micah, I believe it's in Micah chapter 6, where he said, "We want justice to roll down as water." And it just wasn't there. So there had been great corruption and perversion in the Jewish process for many, many years.
Well, probably the same high priest, but then from Stephen was stoned. He wasn't given a trial.
Yeah.
And they killed him.
Sure.
And I didn't think they had the right to kill the Jew.
That's correct. So when you start looking at Jesus, and not just Jesus, but his followers as well, they did not fare too well under the legal system. Paul had some issues with that as well. And, Rome seems to have done a little bit better by Christians, at least for a while, than the Jews. But they got worked up. And it was the law secondary.
Here at this particular time in John 18, Jesus still before Annas, before he went to Caiaphas. And that was always a question that I had. Annas was no longer the high priest here. I understood for a long time that the political, Rome didn't think actually the one that put Caiaphas in office as high priest there. But a lot of them still looked at Annas as the high priest.
Yeah. I'm going to give you an illustration here, probably against my better judgment. But let's say that Hillary Clinton wins the presidential election. There have been some people who have thought that the power behind Hillary will be Bill. Now, you might not believe that, and that may not be true. But still, there would be some people who would say, even though she is commander-in-chief, if that happens, you still have the other person, in this case, the spouse, who's the one who's really driving some things. And that has happened in a lot of different places. And that's what a lot of people suspect here. That yes, Caiaphas, the son-in-law, has taken over, but Daddy, who had his tentacles in so many things, they say that he lived up into his 90s. And he was just a nasty old guy who did all kinds of bad things. And there are some sources which indicate that he finally was booted from power because he just became so powerful. And he was really the powerhouse behind what happened with the Jews and what he said was going to go. So Caiaphas, high priest, sort of a name only, and he certainly did have some authority. But like I say, Annas was the one who seems to be behind him and calling the shots. And that's why they went to his house first. Okay, let's see where we left off. Let's go back here and pick up with Matthew 26, verses 59 and 60, and start looking at some things relative to the witnesses. Who has that? Matthew 26, 59 and 60. All right, Maxine.
Now when the chief priests, the elders, and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none, even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. But at last two false witnesses came forward.
Okay, initially, how many false witnesses, or how many witnesses could they find? Zero. So you can't find any guys who will truthfully witness against the Lord. So if you're going to have people, allege things, what do you need to find? You've got to find liars. And so finally, they did find some, they found many. Let's see Mark chapter 14, verse 59, what we can learn about these witnesses. Mark 14, 59. We'll also get a helper lined up for our next two. And we want to look very carefully at this as well as the next passage. The next passage is after it. Matthew 26, 61, a little later. Matthew 26, 61, Carol. And then John chapter 2, 19 to 21. John 2, Don, 19 and 21. But let's go back right now to Mark 14, verse 59. Gary.
But neither so did their witness agree together.
Okay, so starts out where they can't find anybody. Then they have to scare up some false witnesses. They do get several of those. But as these guys, and you can imagine how that would go, as these fellows begin to offer testimony against the Lord, what's the problem? Their stories don't agree. This is not, though, the only issue that we have. The next point is somewhat important, but then I want to show you something which you may not have ever noticed before. Let's go, Don and Carol, Matthew 26, 61 first. Okay, that's what he said. Then let's take a look at what Jesus has to say in John 2, 19 and 21.
Jesus answered and said unto them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Then said the Jews, 46 years was this temple in building, and wilt thou rear it up in 3 days? But he spake of the temple of his body.
Okay, when you start talking about two different things, you have some problems. That's what we have here. Jesus was talking about his body. That was switched around when he's involved with his trials to mean that he was talking about the physical temple where the Jews worshiped. So that charge was not accurate. Then you have this. Let's take a look at this as a class. Let's open up our Bibles to Matthew 26, 61. That was the passage that Don just read. And this is one of the charges against the Lord. And after you have that passage handy, let's take a look at Mark chapter 14, verse 58. If you've never compared these two verses before, you might say, huh, isn't that interesting? Let's read them, and then I'll read them, and then you can see if you can begin to look at some of the differences. Matthew 26, 61 first. And said, this man said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. Bearing that in mind, let's take a look and see what we have in Mark chapter 14, verse 58. We heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another made without hands. Any differences there? Anything else?
Matthew was talking about his capability. He's able to do it.
Yes.
And in Mark, he's being accused of saying, I will be doing that.
Yes. So again, that is a very small, but that is a very important distinction, where they not only flipped around his words, but you also have that distinction that was brought out by Brian. So when you start having people lie, and their stories, you know, are obviously being made up, it creates the kinds of issues that you have here. But they really didn't seem to care about that. Now, if you turn over to Mark 14, let's take a look and see what we also have in verse 63. And the high priest, we're probably really familiar with, the high priest did what? He rent his clothes, and then he asked, what further need have we of witnesses? Two quick points about this. Let's see. I thought I had a reference on there for Leviticus. Okay, 28. Okay, I wanted to make sure that we had a chance to get through all this, so thank you. All right, we'll try to get back to that. So what do we learn here in the latter part of Mark 14, verse 63? What need do we have of further witnesses? Can you imagine? You're on trial, and this is unfolding, and the judge just says, oh, what further need do we have of witnesses? Now, if they're looking at you favorably, that's probably a good thing. But if you can see that it's headed downhill, and the judge says, oh, we don't need any further witnesses, what are you thinking? You know, it's toast. There is no chance that I'm going to get out of this with my skin, and that was certainly true for the Lord. So now, this ties in a little bit earlier to what we were talking about, a thought with Don. Luke chapter 22, verses 63 and 65. We've had Jesus struck. He's being questioned. And now let's see what we've got. Additional information. Luke 23, verses 22, 63 to 65. Who wants to be a reader? Luke 20, okay. Gary? Luke 22, 63 to 65. Once again, imagine that you have been brought before a judge, and after all the bad stuff that has happened, you're blindfolded, you're struck, you're beaten, people make fun of you and say all these bad things. We can't probably envision that kind of thing in our legal system. It certainly was illegal and immoral among the Jews, but that is exactly what happened to the Lord as he went through his so-called trials. So it just is absolutely stunning. All right, then let's take a look at this. Get this in our heads too. Mark chapter 14, verse 64. We'll look at a couple things here. The first part of the verse and the last part of the verse. Mark 14, 64. Kitty? All right. He's guilty of what? And deserves death. Blasphemy. Bear that in mind, because we're going to come back to that in just a little bit. And based on what you have there, comparing that with how a jury today might vote, If you're going to put somebody to death, and we've probably seen this in a TV show, and this would have been how the Jews did it. If you have a capital case, the judge might do what? How would you want it done? Who thinks he should be put to death? Everybody says, oh yeah, okay. No. If it's me that's there in the prosecution chair, what do I want to hear? I want to hear from all 12. He's guilty, he's guilty, he's guilty, he's guilty. You've got about 70 people here. And rather than do that, rather than write anything down, what is it? Oh, we all think he's guilty. Kill him. Not fair, not legal, not right. All right, then let's take a look at this other point that I wanted to make. Mark chapter 14, verse 63. Gary, you close?
Yeah.
Okay.
Then the high priest rent his clothes and saith, what need we of any further witnesses?
Okay, let's take that quickly and look at Leviticus 10, verse 6. We're probably familiar with the high priest tearing his clothing, and okay, we read along that passage. We're reading along in that passage. We see that detail, and we'll just continue on. But notice something that you may not have noticed before. Leviticus 10:6. Anybody have that? Ready to go? Jeff?
And Moses said unto Aaron and unto Eleazar and unto Ithamar, his sons, uncover not your heads, neither rend your clothes, lest ye die.
All right. High priest, you tear your clothes and what? You merit death. This isn't the only time that you find that. You could also look at Leviticus 21, verse 10. So here you have the high priest doing the very thing that the Old Testament says don't do. But it's kind of like, well, I don't care. I can do that. I can be that emphatic. But let's make sure we deal with who instead of me. Let's get rid of him instead of me. Yes, he was. So, I mean, that doesn't excuse things, but that probably was a state of mind. A couple of the passages real quick. Let's get these lined up. John chapter 18, verses 29 and 30. Luke 23, verse 2. Mark 14, 65. And Luke 23, 2. So if you read Luke 23, we'll have you look at it twice. And then Luke 23, verses 4 and 5. John 18, 29 and 30. Who wants to read that for us? All right, Don? All right, now what was the charge we said 3 minutes ago that Jesus had facing him? He's a blasphemer. They take him to Pilate. Pilate's a Roman. He's got the authority to kill Jesus. And what's the charge? Is it blasphemy? Oh, no. They don't even have a charge. What's the Jews' response? Oh, we wouldn't be bothering you if he wasn't guilty of something. Are you kidding me? You want to kill this guy, and that's what you're going to the Roman governor with? But that's exactly what they did. So once again, you begin to see how illegal, how immoral, how unrighteous this was. Eventually, though, the Jews lay this charge against Jesus as they're interacting with Pilate. Luke 23, 2. Who's got it? All right, Don. They're not so interested in the blasphemy charge. They sort of allude to that, but now they change things around a little bit so the charges would have been more attractive to Rome. Now, can you imagine being prosecuted for something? And after a decision has been made, it really doesn't work out well, so they just sort of revise the charges against you? That would be unbelievable, unheard of, but that's exactly what happened. All right, then take a look at Mark 14:65. Anybody there? Carol?
And some began to spit at him and to blindfold him and to beat him with their fists and to say to him, prophesy. And the officers received him with slaps in the face.
Okay.
Mark 14:65.
Yeah, that was what I had. Let's scrap that for now. I don't have my right train of thought on that. But I do have Luke 23, verses 4 and 5. Let's close it out there. Betty? Okay, thank you. So the charges were changed around a little bit, and after Pilate finally gets the charges, what's he say? How much of a basis is there to condemn the Lord? Zero. But the Jews are persistent. The Jews still want him killed. And finally, that is what happens. So when you start looking at what happened to Jesus as far as the illegal acts involved with his trials, it really was unbelievable. And that'll hopefully set the stage for later classes. Thank you.